Accession number 4549, Reel 7.
Mr. Viles, Reel 7. In 1934, you left Iraq for India. How did that come about?
Well, actually, when I went to Iraq, the tour there was only for 2 years, but I had signed on for another one and tried for a fourth. But by that time, it was opposed by the Air Ministry, and I had to move, so I went on the second boat instead of the first. So I had 3.5 years in Iraq. And then we were in train back down to Basra from Baghdad, and we caught the boat at Basra. And unfortunately for me, it was the same boat that I came out from England, the Dorsetshire. And it was the same circumstances, and it was a week's trip. A week, was it? Or 10 days? A week or 10 days trip from Basra down the Gulf, round the corner to Karachi, to India. And there we were in train for our stations. And I was posted to Rizalpur up on the northwest frontier, right up against the Himalayas almost. And that consisted of a horrible train journey, but a much better one than in Iraq. We had these carriages where they had slat seats, and there was two above your head which you pushed up and they laid against the back. But at night time when you went to sleep, those came down, so that you had six sleeping in this small carriage on these slats. And no blankets, mattresses or anything, just two or three blankets each, and that's where you had to sleep. No pillows, you had to make your own pillow or something, or your kit or something. And we had 2 days and two nights on that, going across the Sindh Desert, and getting up to Lahore, and from Lahore to Nowshera was the nearest railroad station, and then from Nowshera by road to Rizalpur. Now, I beg your pardon, from Lahore to Rawalpindi to Nowshera, that was a railroad that finished at Peshawar, and then the small gauge railway from Peshawar went on up through the Khyber.
What was Rizalpur cantonment like?
Very nice. Very nice station indeed. I think, in fact, we're probably one of the best in India, except with the exception of the aircraft park at Lahore. That's where all the main overhauls were done.
Why was Rizalpur so nice?
It was nicely situated. It had open ground. We had a golf course there. We had a swimming pool there in the station. On the airfield, we had a golf course. We had very good quarters. We had a very good canteen. There was no NAFI in India. It was run by the Indians. And the owner was always called the Babu. He was the owner. And very good canteens and very good houseboys to do our buttons and our boots, the same as in Iraq. And all our washing, all our tidying up. All we did was, when we finished work, stepped out of your clothes and left them on the floor and went for an afternoon's siesta. You packed up there, you see, at about 1 o'clock in the summer, and in the winter, 2. And, well, we just about had everything there. We had a small village just down the road for buying goods of any souvenir type that we wanted, suitcases and things like that. In fact, I still got my suitcase, and they were a standard price. That was 10 rupees. That's 10 one and sixpences, 15 shillings. And it's as big as any case you'll buy. It's quarter-inch buffalo hide, hand-sewn, and inlaid with green velvet for 15 shillings. And that's heavier, empty, what a normal suitcase is that I take away, packed full of clothes. And I've still got it, and it's still as good as ever.
What was the work you were doing at Rizalpur?
I was posted straight to my to 11 Squadron, and I was posted to A Flight 11 Squadron there, under the command of Flight Lieutenant Battle, and my commanding officer was my old commanding officer from Holton days. He was now Squadron Leader Leeport Trench. He was the RAF rugby scrum half in my Holton days. A Kiwi, but he was a terror.
Why?
Oh, I think he was a little he was more than over-officious. And he'd been a flight lieutenant then for about 11 years before he was promoted. He was a First World War captain, flight lieutenant. He was a very exceptional pilot, very good pilot. And whether this had affected his idea of the Air Force and he was taking it out on others at random or not, I don't know. But he seemed to be rather over-officious on many things he needn't have been. And I think he would have got better results from the whole of his squadron had he gone with him a little more than against him, as he seemed to be doing, he tried to do, I think. But after saying that, all in all, he was the commanding officer and we just had to go in and bear it.
Was your work there, your own personal work, the same as the work that you'd been doing at Hinnide?
With 55 Squad, except that I immediately had to take up the air gunner's course again there, in the fact that I had to learn more. I had to learn photography there, and I also had to learn the habits and the situations and the places where the different tribes lived. And what was the cause of all the trouble we were having on the frontier between them? We had history books on this, which we were given to read and to learn. And at the end of 6 months, we took an air gunner's examination there then, and you had to get 80% or over not to take that examination again. If you failed, if you got under 80% on any subjects, then 6 months later you had to take that exam again, and so on, until you got over 80. And if you didn't get over 80, you kept on taking the examination. Well, I said it the first time and got it right away, over 80, and I didn't have to sit it again. And I was very fortunate that the gunner on my aircraft at the time, he was posted home 6 months later, and I stepped straight into his shoes and I came on strength as a full-time air gunner with my own aircraft and my own pilot.
What did the photography work involve?
Well, for instance, I took two special jobs I did. I went down once with my pilot to Agra, just outside Delhi, and I took oblique photographs, it's angled photographs out the side, of the Taj Mahal and what would have been the Black Taj Mahal across the river had the king of the Genghis Khan outfit was building for his own memorial. His wife was in the white one, which now stands, and he'd started to build the black one and had got the walls built, and his son poisoned him before he spent all his money or got rid of all the money he had. He would have got nothing. It cost goodness knows what to build those places. And the other one was that I had to go up and we had some trouble up in the Black Hills near Abbottabad. And they wanted a large area photographing. And at that time, I was the flight official photographer. So I was given all the details of this area that I had to photograph. So I had to plan it out on my maps. And I had to start from the riverbed, and that was a certain height, so I had to work out then all the stops at that height to start with, to take those photographs in the riverbed and work across the Black Mountains to a depth of about 80 miles. And at that height, as the hills came up, the hills were marked, I had the heights of the hills as they came up, and I had to work out the stops, so I had to stop my camera down to go slower or faster as the case may be if there was a valley I suddenly dropped over. And I had to work it all out first before I went on the job. Well, having got it done, it took me approximately a week to get it all sorted out. And each place I had to find a starting point so that my first line of flight was overlapped a third by my second flight. And each line of flight had to be overlapped a third going. So I had to work it all out this way and that way lap. The double lap, forward and sideways. Well, I did the job. It took me 3 days. I did the job, and when it was finally assembled, I had one small little gap I had to fill in. And I went back, and I took another 34 pictures to fill that gap in. Then I saw the finished job. I went down and saw the finished job. What they do, they take each picture, and they take the first run and lay it down complete. Then they take the second run, and they strip off, with a very fine knife, they strip the width of the photographic paper so it's a fine edge on that one-third. And they stick that down over the first lap, left, overlapping, and it goes up, overlapping itself as well. And so they go up line after line until the complete job is there. And you've got a complete picture of the area you've taken. Then they photograph that to cut out all the lines. And you've got just one picture then, 6 foot by 6 foot, of the area you've done with everything on it. And that's where we didn't have a bad accident. I believe it was 60 Squadron. They were up at Abbottabad, and they were doing the operations up there against this lot. They were near them. And something happened with a bomb, and it blew up. And it blew up that aircraft and killed 3 airmen and the pilot. And it also damaged about another 4 aircraft. I remember that very well.
What was the nature of this trouble in the Black Mountains?
I never got to learn what the actual trouble was, except that they were having trouble between the two sects of the Mohammedans. There was two sects, as I mentioned before, and they were always saying, no, this is Mohammed, and the other was saying, no, it's his brother that was Mohammed. And they were always arguing about this until it got to guns then. And they were shooting at each other, and of course that started trouble. Oh, this happened to be near to Kohat than us, so they took it over. 60 Squadron and 27 Squadron.
Were you actually engaged on any operations yourself in India?
Yes, we had operational duties against the Faker of Alangar was the first one, and then the second one was the Faker of IPI. The one, we used to call him the Red Faker. He had a red beard. We saw a colored photograph of him. And the Faker of Alangar eventually came to terms. And that was settled after about 5 months of operations. And we did exactly the same. We went out and warned them, white pamphlet. And if they didn't stop, we just went out and wiped out the village. I remember going on a trip in a small village one day, and all the gunners in my flight had been out there, and they couldn't hit this village. And it was situated on a river bend like that. And the village was in that bend, and it consisted of a square like that of wall.
Inside the river bend?
Yes, that was the outside of the actual little village. In this is only a little square, and up here were all huts. And up here were all huts. I visualize this very well because I won a lot of beer on this. And then across there was another diagonal wall. And you had animals attached here, horses on that side and cows on this side. And they all lived along there. And our 3 gunners had been over, and for some reason, no one had got one in the village. And I went over with, I think it was 812 pounders and one cider. I took one underneath the fuselage for a cider. But I did get the wind off my corporal air gunner. I asked him for the wind. I said, what wind did you find out there? And he told me, and I tried it, and I found that he was out. So I decided to do my own run to get my wind from my bomb sight, and I got it quite a different angle to what he'd got it, a matter of about 8 or 10 degrees difference, and I decided to use my own. Well, Shiner Wright, our flight sergeant armor, said, look, he said, we haven't hit this thing. For every bomb you put in there, he said, you get two, that was later, bottles of beer. And that was Dutch beer. It was good stuff, that was, too. Well, the first one I dropped my cider first, and my cider went just there, about there.
Just outside the wall, near the corner.
Yeah. So I knew I hadn't got to alter my sights on my bomb sight. It was just a matter of running dead straight on, and keep my pilot dead straight on, left or right, left, right, left, right, wherever he had to go. My next one went there.
Hit the houses along one
right
side.
Right on the houses, and blew all that corner out. The next one hit the wall there.
The wall to which the animals were attached.
The line, yes. The next one went in the middle there, in an open space. I don't know what damage it did.
Inside the walls.
Inside the walls. The next one went just here. I undershot that one there.
Just outside the wall.
Then I put another one in there, right through the houses. Then I had another one in here.
Inside the compound again.
I didn't hit this row of houses at all. But I got one very close right in the corner here that blew out the wall and knocked off that corner right off there. That had already gone there. And then I knocked some more off there as well. That knocked some of the wall off there. This knocked a great big hole in the wall and all the cat were flying around. So having done that, he decided to go down and we went down and we front gunned all these animals and killed as many as we could. When we got back, I had a picture of this as well with me. I'd taken a picture with me. They give you a picture to show you the village, because you've got to find it first. And up in those hills, it takes some finding. They're way up some of those hills. We were flying at around 16,000, 17,000 feet to get to it. Open cockpits, no oxygen. So you can see under the circumstance we were flying. Yet we never felt it, funnily enough. And when I came back, I showed China Wright this picture. I said, well, there you are. I said, you owe me somewhere around about 14 or 16 bottles of beer. And I just put a cross where everyone went on the picture and gave it to him. He said, well, thank God somebody's hit it. He gave me the beer. I was with Sergeant Greenwood that day.
What did you think about the policy of bombing the villages and shooting up the animals? Do you think it was a good policy?
It was the only policy that we had, actually. There was no other. We couldn't get in to get them in the hills. The army certainly couldn't get in with their artillery, because they always pick their own ground, these people. If they get out of a village, they'll pick their own ground. Unless you can catch them in an open space, in a valley, which you can get into easily and get out of, but you've got to realize that if you get in that valley, you're going to be shot at all the time from the sides. So there isn't much hope for you, really, so the only alternative is to do it from the air. And after giving them a 48-hour warning, and we dropped thousands and thousands of pamphlets there on them before we ever attempted to go out, and we gave them 48 hours, and then we get a report they were still there, or they'd moved out. And if they moved out, we didn't touch them then. We let them fight it out in the open between themselves. But then we get a moan from one of them saying, look, you paying us so much a year to keep quiet, not to start a war. Right, we're not starting a war, but so-and-so's starting a war from so-and-so, and what are you going to do about it? Are you going to back us or back them? So then we have to do something.
Did you ever get shot at from the ground on these operations in India?
I never knew of myself being shot at anyway. And I heard of one case before my time in India there, about 2 years before I got there, of a gunner and his pilot. His pilot was killed, actually, shot from the ground or from mountainside, and he brought the aircraft back himself and landed it and killed himself. And he was awarded a posthumous DFM. That was before my time, though. That was a story I heard, to me, secondhand. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. Because as far as I was concerned, I couldn't find any records of it because there was no place to find any. Not for me. I couldn't go and dig out the alcoves or anything like that.
How did you get on with the local population there?
Very well. They were all robbers. Every one of them. If you went for a pair of shoes, or you went to get a silk shirt made, or some clothes made, or whatever you wanted, souvenirs or whatever, they robbed you. You picked something, you'd say, oh, I want so-and-so, whatever the man might be. And he'd say, yes, Sab, that'll cost you $10. Immediately, you knocked two-thirds of that straight off. And you knew you were still making a profit, but you didn't know then how much he was making. Until I ordered an ivory bracelet cut from the solid tusk. They cut a piece of tusk out, about that wide. And they hand-carved that, and they cut it down on the joint, and they put a little peg down in there. They smooth it off and join it up again. They put a hole down, they put a little peg down there to hold it. They have little loops to go over the top. They extend it with a little hole loop at the top, and one in the middle, one at the bottom, which goes into a slot the other side, and it butts up. And they put a little peg down. Beautifully done. And they had a standard price for these of ten rupees, 15 baht, which was, for ivory, well, and workmanship. And you should see some of the most cosmopolitan tools you ever saw in your life. They used to drill with their feet on a string, with a piece of metal that they used to sharpen at the end and harden, and fix it into this string and a piece of wood that went into the back of this like bow thing. Then they push this string up and down and spin this thing to drill through this ivory. And fantastic their work on the ivory was. And I'd ordered one of this for my cousin in Canada. And I went down and got it, and he said, oh, it's just come in, Mr. Varsap. Just come in. And he opened it up there for me, and inside was the invoice. And the invoice was three rupees. That's what he was paying for it, 3 rupees. So that fellow was making a profit who'd made it. He was making 7 rupees out of me, this bloke. I said, you're not going to... I picked this up and looked at it. I said, what? Let's have a look at that invoice. I took it out of his hand. I said, 3 rupees? I said, you've been robbing every Air Force man here for years now. I said, I'll fix you now. Oh, Sam, he said, Sam, he said, from me, he said, present for you. For you, present.
So he gave
said,
you.
But you mustn't tell. If you tell, he said, never come in my shop again. I said, I'll take your present. I said, and a lot more before I go. Otherwise, I say, you're on the mat. Okay, sir. But not too much, not too much. I have wife and so many children to keep. So I did find that out. And then when we left, when we were due to come home, the last thing everyone did was parade on the square with the station sergeant major there. And then you'd have the Dersey man, that was the man that made all the shirts and stuff. Then you had the Dobie man who washed all your clothes. And then you had the man who made all the shoes, I forget what they called him now. And the different wallahs for foods. You'd have an egg wallah, you'd have a cake wallah, cigarette wallah, tea wallah, and so on. They'd all be lined up. And of course, you never paid for anything, you just signed for it. Charlie Chaplin, Buffalo Bill Cody, something like that. Everybody signed different names. And he would go along at L.A.C. Valls. How much does he owe you? Nothing, sir. 15 rupees, sir. 5 rupees, sir. Nothing, sir. Nothing. 4 rupees. You owe these people so-and-so. Now, what are you going to do about it? And you always give them the same answer. Say, well, I haven't got any money. When I get back to England, they pay me. I'll send it to you, and you can pay them. And he said, you heard what Valsap said? When he gets back to England and they pay him, you send it to me. And when I get it, I'll pay it. Okay? All right, Vals, off you go.
And did they send it for me?
No, one never sent anything. They'd been robbed all the time they were there. Every airman was robbed. No airman got away from that camp with a profit. Over the long haul of his service there, that man, no matter who he was, had made a profit out of him, no matter if he owed him 15 rupees. He'd made more than that. We used to go up to Mardan, to the, which is about 15 miles up the road, which is a silk town. They sold nothing else but silk, which is smuggled across the border. And you could go there and you could buy a bale of silk, 50 yards long and a yard wide. Pure silk, any color you wanted. A bale 50 yards long and a yard wide, and that would cost you 10 rupees, Mardan. Now, you could bring that back, and you could say to your jersey, I want a silk shirt making today, so I can wear it tonight to the cinema. Okay, sir. You look, well, sir, yeah, I have your measurement, yes, yes, okay. That will take so many yards of white silk. I say, okay. I said, hold it. And I go outside and I cut off 3 yards of white silk. And I said, there you are. How much now? Because they were five rupees each. That's 5, 1, 6, 7, 6. In the old money. And I said, how much now? Oh, sir, very good, very good. For you, 3 rupees. 2 rupees. Take it or leave it. Okay, sir, 2 rupees. You knew he was making, he was doing you then. He was making a profit. Because he'd have his son or his cousin or 2 sons or daughter all helping him. He didn't pay them. They just did it for nothing, for the food, rice. They used to live on about a rupee a day.
Coming on to the equipment that you had with the 11th Squadron, was it the same as with 55 Squadron?
No, we had Hawker Hearts. A much faster aircraft, a much stronger aircraft, a better equipped aircraft, one of the finest aircraft I think I've ever flown in.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think for the fact that it had a Rolls-Royce engine, it was one thing. Hardly ever let you down. I only knew of one instance that ever let the squadron down. And it was beautifully built and shaped. The accommodation for the pilot and gunner was much better than in the Wapiti. I could get down in the back of a Hart and lay down and go to sleep. Well, I couldn't in the Wapiti because of the photographic holder in the back. You couldn't get by. Well, in the Hart, you see, all you did was just take the whole thing out and you had all the back to lay down in the fuselage. You could crawl right down to the back in a Hart if you wanted to get to the controls to look at them. And they were a very sturdy aircraft, because I knew of an instance later on where my commanding officer, the chief flying instructor, tried to break the back of a Hawker aircraft. And he put it into a dive and dived it down to full bore from about 16,000 feet down to about 5, and then pulled her out with full stick. He tried to break the back.
Why was he trying to do that?
He wanted to see if it would break up. But they never could. They never did break one up. And it was one of the Hawkers then were the fastest aircrafts around, the Fury, the Demon, and the Hart. The Hart, being a two-seater, was not quite as fast as the Demon and the Fury. But they were pushing 300 miles an hour, which wasn't bad for a two-seater aircraft. Open cockpit.
Did they perform according to their specification?
Absolutely. And better sometimes. They had twin front guns for the pilot and one for the gunner on a swivel. We had these swivel. We had a ring which would turn round on its own, and also a ring with a gun on which you could angle whichever way you wanted. Normal wind vane sight, just the same. The same guns exactly as we had with the Wapitis on 55 Squadron, exactly the same. The guns were exactly the same, both for the pilot and for the gunner. But we could carry more, a heavier weight of bombs. In fact, we were the first squadron to carry 500 pounders. 1917, 500 pounders. And we had to do a raid on the village during the second lot of trouble with the Faker VP. and I went out with the corporal gunner, who later retired as Air Chief Marshal, Guns Grundy. He was our corporal air gunner, ex-apprentice, and Sophie Tucker from Bath, and myself. And we had two 500-pounders, Tucker and I, and Grundy had 412 sighters and two 250s on each side.